Welcome to the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. Today I'm speaking with fashion designer Maria Graschvogel. This is the second conversation I'm having with her since I spoke to her for the first episode of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. Let's see how things have changed since then. Maria, welcome to the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start by going back in time a bit. You've been in business for 30 years. And I just wanted to ask what the biggest changes have been to you and the business over those 30 years.
I think, I suppose I've seen a huge amount of change actually during that time in the industry. And then I suppose sort of how that has perhaps affected my thinking or whatever. So when I first started, Fashion Week was very much a two sort of seasons a year event. And you'd have your show, and if you got a picture in the paper, then you were super lucky. And then I think with the advent of the sort of internet and social media in particular, you started to see catwalk shows suddenly kind of being everywhere. And I think that kind of immediate accessibility to something that was essentially a trade show or something that was really for press and buyers, being able to see the collection in February that you weren't able to purchase until September led to an incredible kind of speeding up of the industry. Because the more of this imagery, it almost created this sort of fatigue in a way from the consumer. And I think at a certain point, I was sort of 20 years into my business, that I started to kind of, let's say, question that. I found that department stores were asking for more and more collections from me. I didn't necessarily feel that that was where I wanted to go, although I did try it for a little while. And I started to also see at 20 years that a lot of my clients were kind of coming back to me saying, oh, actually, you know, could you perhaps alter this armhole for me? It's now a little bit tight, you know, perhaps my body shape has changed a little bit. So we started doing alterations, we started doing repairs, we started, sometimes the moths have eaten a hole in the back of the coat. Have you still got this fabric? Could you fix it for me? So we started doing all of that. And I think what it made me realize is that my clients were still wearing the things that they bought from me 5, 10, 15, even 20 years before. And that perhaps I needed to think about my collection in a completely different way. That, you know, I suppose I always slightly knew my product was timeless, but it really brought it to the fore that actually this is the way that I want to actually take my business now too. So I started making quite a slow change from probably 10 years ago now, more or less, where I stopped showing, doing catwalk shows, pulled out of department stores. And so we now still sort of sell to independent boutiques. I wanted to work with people that really understood this concept of actually you're buying for the woman, or the woman is choosing her clothes for her and not necessarily for a kind of season or for something that felt very ephemeral or throwaway. So I think that that's sort of essentially how I've evolved, but it's not necessarily that I've evolved. It's just that I've perhaps become more confident in being able to express this is who I am and this is the work that I do within, you know, the fashion industry, as it were. It's really about empowering women to find their own kind of confidence through how they dress.
And is that empowerment of women, I mean, that's a newish thing, isn't it? That women feel much more confident, you know, they're less, I don't know if they're less body conscious, but they're more body confident.
Well, I think that, you know, actually the way I view clothes and fashion is that it's actually an expression of who you are as a woman or man, actually. It's an expression of who you are. You show something of your identity or of who you want to be through the clothes that you choose to wear. And it's not, you know, in the past we sort of looked at, there's been lots of programs about if you're this body shape, you must wear this sort of thing. But I really don't believe in that kind of prescription, because I've seen women of all different body shapes, but it's so much more than that. You know, I've seen really curvy women want to show off their body and be really body confident and really enjoy their curves. I've equally seen somebody else with the same shape body that really is self-conscious about their curves, and they would dress in a completely different way. So your personal style or your expression of you comes from a place that is so much deeper than a surface look. It is something that's really internal to yourself that you really have to kind of channel and understand. So I think what's happened through this, let's say, last even century, actually, is women have become much more confident in their own self-expression. And you've even seen, actually, through fashion, how, say, in the 50s or the 60s or even the 70s, there was a very prescriptive style that everybody followed. Everybody followed a trend. And that started to sort of disappear and change through the 80s, through the 90s. And actually, I don't remember even the last time somebody would ask me what is the latest colours or what is the latest trends, because trends from about 2007 have all but disappeared. Everybody wears what they want. But I think in some ways, although that's happened, the narrative around fashion hasn't necessarily changed to reflect that.
But do you think that's widespread? Because I suppose they're fashion tribes, aren't they? And there's still people that, you know, maybe not necessarily your customer, but there's still those customers who perpetuate this notion of fashion and trend.
Well, I think, as I said, fashion is ultimately an expression of who you are. Mm. So let's say there's, you know, you're a teenager. You want to dress the same as all your peers. So you're going to choose the clothes that reflect that, because that's who you are in this moment. You want to express that part of you that wants to belong to that tribe. You're identifying with that tribe and you're using your clothes in a way as an expression of that. As you move through life, as you change through life, you perhaps lose the parts of you that need to belong and you become more kind of yourself over time. And I think that I've seen that play out across, you know, many different clients. And some people reach that point a little earlier and some people reach that point a little later, but it's a journey. It's a journey through a lifetime of finding your own inner confidence in your own expression of, actually, I love this because it feels like me. And when you achieve that, I mean, if you look at all the people we've ever admired for style, you know, whether it's Audrey Hepburn, Katharine Hepburn, Marlene Dietrich, I mean, you know, you can name, or even Kate Moss, you know, none of them were trend followers. They all inhabited their very own style. And other people said, I want to look like that. The reason that you want to look like that is because actually they shine from the inside with their own light and their own style. And I truly believe that.
So I wonder, and this might be a bit contentious, was it the designer behind them who defined that style for them as opposed to them defining it for themselves?
I don't really believe that it was, actually. I really believe that, you know, certainly if you see, I mean, in the case of, say, Coco Chanel, it's one and the same. Mm. And lots of people admired her own style. But I think that what ends up happening is somebody resonates. So, you know, they find a designer that they work with that they resonate. But quite a lot of these iconic women, especially now, it's not just one designer they're wearing. It can be many. Mm. But there's a certain style that they exude. Does that make sense?
It does. I don't know that I necessarily agree, but it does. It does, because I think, you know, with Audrey Hepburn, for example, mm. I mean, we're now talking about styles from the 50s, 60s.
Yes, of course.
and Givenchy, you know, Breakfast at Tiffany's, you know, that was iconic just in, you know, in the construction of the film mm-hmm. and the clothing that went with the film. And that is what epitomized her style.
I know, but I think that there was a relationship that happened there yeah. between the designer and her that just worked in terms of her, the expression of that style.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what I mean, is yeah. that it wasn't her on her own. It was, you know, it was the It was a collaboration.
It's a collaboration, yeah. But I don't know that it's necessarily the designer dictating to the person who's wearing it. I suppose that's what I'm saying.
Right.
So I think it becomes that particular person says, oh, you know what, I really resonate with what this designer's doing. So it becomes something that sort of flowers and blossoms. And I've seen that, say, for example, in my own work with women that I've dressed, I'm not imposing my style on that woman.
No.
They're often discovering their style through
you.
Through my clothes, yes.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit of a kind of collaboration and a marriage, and that's where clothes become such an important part of actually that expression and who you are. And I feel like it, you know, fashion needs to be seen much more like that and less about kind of trend and, you know, copying looks less necessarily. It's about discovering who you are, seeing it as a joy to discover that style, to play with styles, to see that actually it is a natural progression to progress from that sort of teenage experimental, trying to find out who you are, all the way through to kind of later in life. And it's a different journey for everybody, just like any learning, just like at school, there's a different learning curve for every child.
Sure.
It's a different process for every person finding their style over time.
And I agree with that to a point. I mean, this is a slightly different conversation we're having. But anyway, no, I agree to a point. But I think over the past probably 5-10 years, fashion has changed so much in terms of the business, consumption. Celebrity,
yes,
influences, all of those sorts of things, where it's, you know, I suppose the cynic in me would say that it's fashion is so orchestrated. So you see red carpets. It's not who, you know, what are you wearing anymore? It's who are you wearing? It's become quite pretentious in the showcase.
Mm-hmm.
And that showcase is all about money and stylists. Stylists are paid huge amounts of money by the designers to get the celebrity in the dress that, or the outfit, you know, brands are sponsoring the celebrities, and that's fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation we are going to lead on to is about luxury.
Mm.
And for me, there's a slight conflict, because for me, fashion is not necessarily luxury. And I was just wondering, you know, thinking about all of that, what you thought about that.
Well, I suppose in some ways that's why I kind of changed what I do, because I didn't feel like that was a part of my brand, of who I am, what I stand for. So, you know, I suppose I chose to step out of, let's call it, the fashion circles. But, you know, ultimately, well, what is fashion? You know, fashion, luxury, we can call it, in some ways you can call it what you like, right? But if I'm going to say I'm the designer of clothes, there is an element of, you know, the word that's used typically is fashion. That's that the connotation of that has been associated with something that is fast and consumerism. But I suppose that's why I call myself slow fashion. This is really not about fast fashion. This is not about changing your look every moment. This is about something much more considered and slow. And it did used to be called fashion, even in the times when the things lasted longer and you kept things in your wardrobe for 10, 15, 20 years. So, it's a difficult one, because I don't know what to call it if I don't call it fashion, but I understand what you're saying, that it has become associated with something that really is not reflective of the craft and the beauty that goes into making those clothes. Because to create something that stands the test of time, both in terms of its design and also its functionality and longevity, there is so much that goes into it. It's not just a style. It's not just something that is a look that looks cool for a moment. It's a considered design like any other considered design, whether it's a piece of furniture or a building, or it's a considered piece of design. You have to think about it. You have to create the pattern in the right way. That pattern on the body, the way that it's cut, affects the longevity of a garment. The fabric that you choose affects the longevity of a garment, how it's cared for, and, you know, the ease of care can affect the longevity of a garment. And also all the finishes, how the seams are made, the way the pockets are positioned, all of the internal construction affects the longevity of a garment. But people don't necessarily understand that within all of that wrapped up is fashion or luxury or whatever, in a way, you'd like to call it. And perhaps it is better to call it luxury, but luxury is such a broad word and very overused these days, even in the context of things that actually have no real sense of luxury about them. You know, for me, luxury in clothes is the ability to put something on and almost not have to think about it. You know, it's so beautifully cut, so beautifully made that you're not fiddling with it, you're not thinking about it. It just becomes a part of you in a way.
Yeah, because I think, you know, about showcases, whether they're a fashion show or whether they're an event, a red carpet event or something. I mean, it's showcasing, really. And very seldom do you have a designer before a show at whatever company it is saying what you've just said. You know, I think about the cut, I think about the material. They come up with these, narratives around, gender, around fluidity, around the times, around the environment, around sustainability. They don't often talk about fabrics, weave of fabrics, drape of fabrics, how the clothes necessarily feel on the person wearing them.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. And I think that is the kind of nature of the industry a little bit. And certainly it was one of the things I struggled with a lot when I was doing a show, because, you know, people would ask the inspiration, and you know, really my inspiration is always the woman. I think about the woman, I think about the body, I think about the way something's cut and the way it's going to feel and how I want to feel in something, not just how I want to look. And there's a relationship between the garment and the woman, actually. It's a little bit of an invisible relationship, but that sort of thing of comfort, in a sense, the way the fabric feels on your body. And if something's cut beautifully, you just don't notice it. You can move freely. You can, you know, inhabit your body freely. And in fact, I was having this conversation recently. There was a big conversation in sustainability around elastane. It's a very complicated fabric to remove. And actually, I don't use elastane. I don't like it. I believe that if you cut a garment well, you know, everyone talks about need for it for comfort. You don't. If you cut a garment really beautifully, it will be comfortable without the elastane. It will last longer because elastane degrades over time. And obviously, it's much more kind of beneficial from a sort of further use point of view, from a recycling perspective, if you don't have the elastane in there. And I think too often, elastane, like, you know, many inventions or new things, are there to speed things up, make things more convenient. And actually, what it's done is said, well, we don't need to be cut as well. But if you imagine you've got the elastane doing the stretch, you're putting more stress on those seams that are not cut in the right place through the body. So those seams will come apart more easily, you know? Yeah. So all of that is, you know, in my opinion, that skill of cut and fit, which is a little bit of a dying art, which I feel is a real shame, which is a core part of fashion or clothes or creating something beautiful for someone's body.
Mm. And I think part of that debate is around the commercial viability of a product, isn't it? You know, fashion companies, or all companies, you know, the point of them being in existence is obviously to make money. You know, we live in a consumer society, capitalist society, and, you know, what we were talking about earlier, I mean, that's business. A lot of it is formulaic. You know, if this trouser works, well, we'll make it every season. It will be in a size, you know, whatever, across 5 sizes in 10 different fabrics. There'll be minimal investment in cut and in R&D, probably. But that's what fashion is. You know, it's about, to me, it's about newish products every season. But then we have other makers, designers like yourselves who are more concerned with where the life, the longevity of the product as opposed to selling 55 of the product every week?
I think, to be honest, it's quite interesting how fashion has really sped up and the sort of cultural implications around that. I was doing some research on this actually and discovered that if you take, your, let's call it average salary back in the 50s, do you know how many dresses, or the average price of a dress, you could buy with an annual salary?
No.
Three.
Right.
Do you know how many that is now? With an average salary now and the average price of a dress?
That's hundreds.
537 or some sort of really large number, which is a little bit shocking. And I think what that shows is that we've made fashion cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And everyone talks about, but what about the poor people that can't afford? But actually, it's a cultural thing that we're now buying that much more. I even remember when I was growing up, an investment in whether it was a coat, a dress, a pair of trousers, we weren't buying designer products at all. But it was a huge investment for my mum to buy something for me as a piece of clothing. It was seen as a really important purchase. Yeah. And now I don't believe that a piece of clothing is seen as an important purchase because it's so cheap. It has become much more throwaway. And the other side of that is, in order to become so cheap, the quality of fabrics over time has degraded. And the quality of manufacturing is degraded. Corners get cut, cutting techniques have changed, all kinds of things, because we've valued the way something looks over the way something really is, because we see it's okay to just, buy, dispose, replace, buy, dispose, replace. But actually, it's that in itself is, in my opinion, unsustainable for a kind of the future of the planet. I think that's the very thing that in some ways we need to kind of reverse back out of and come back to a place where fashion is appreciated for beauty, the gorgeousness of a garment, and the expression of you, that you can discover yourself in a way through clothes. You can still be playful, you can still enjoy clothes, but enjoy them in a different way, rather than viewing it as a disposable thing. It's the same as a water bottle. We're now understanding the impact of our plastic water bottles, our disposable coffee cups, our disposable lifestyle that has been built up around us. For me, it's the same thing, that clothing needs to return back to perhaps being more expensive again. And it needs to be more expensive because we need better fabric and we need to make it better. We need to value the craft of putting a garment together again, as we used to. And I really believe that a little bit of returning back to move forward is important.
And that's, a lot of that is about education.
Yes.
And the conversation we were having earlier around trying to educate people around the things you're talking about, fabrics being more sustainable, things lasting longer, not being compelled to buy something, because it's £4.50 and you can buy 10 of them and wear them twice. How do you get that message out?
It's a slow process. It's a slow process of education, of building that awareness. I mean, we've seen it happen in so many different areas. If you look at the food industry as an area that at one point was quite oversaturated with cheap food, and now the consciousness has crept in. And obviously there's still people buying the cheap food, but there's a much greater awareness of what that does to your body. There's a much greater kind of general feeling that people want to eat well and be healthy. I think that, even things like drinking or not drinking is much more socially acceptable now than it was even 5 years ago, actually. So if you think that cultural shifts like that can happen, I've seen it with furniture. Even 5, 10 years ago, you know, it was really easy and very cheap to buy the most incredible pieces of vintage furniture. And now it's becoming much more expensive, much more difficult to find really good pieces because the supply and demand thing has shifted. People are starting to realize that those older pieces of furniture were just so much better made. Mm. And all the things that you put together with flat packs just fall apart after a year or two. So actually the investment into something that costs a little more is worth it over time. And you look at something and you say, gosh, it's just beautiful. You know, it's a piece of art, it's craft. And I think the same education will happen slowly in fashion, but it's not something that will happen overnight. I mean, even in the last 2 years, I've seen the conversation shift on sustainability away from purely fabric and fiber. People go, oh, if you switch to eco cotton or this fiber or fabric, but that's ultimately not going to change the way things are unless we fix the underlying issue of there's just too much stuff being made that's not really needed, you know?
Yeah, there definitely is too much stuff. I think, you know, I read somewhere that there are 3 billion pairs of sneakers made every year. And so that's 3 billion pieces of plastic that is not biodegradable.
But the biggest criminal part for me is that probably within that is a huge number that are discounted, not sold, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's a portion of wastage that could immediately just be taken out with better planning, better understanding of kind of matching supply and demand. Mm. And that's essentially what I've done with my business model, completely taken all of that out. So we have no wastage anymore.
Apparently Crocs, I don't know how many they make, but Crocs and all the copies that are made by, you know, own brand supermarkets are not biodegradable. So, I mean, can you imagine how many Crocs they make a year? But anyway, that's...
I mean, I'm not saying, listen, I think it's really important that we fix the fibre and fabric issues too.
Yeah.
But I think what I observed is, you know, certainly in clothes, I know less about shoes and sneakers, but certainly in clothes, as fashion sped up, sell-throughs went down. So when you were selling through, you know, a certain percentage of sell-through at full price, and then you'd have a certain amount that was discounted, that changed to having a lot more being discounted. And discounted product, people buy it often just because it's cheap, as opposed to because they love it and they care for it. So quite often that portion of product is not worn or not cared for or not loved in the same way as the pieces that were purchased at full price. So essentially that becomes part of this landfill or part of this waste issue. And so what we've sought to do with sort of rethinking the business model is to be able to say, well, instead of doing this collection that's this big, I'm going to do a collection that's much smaller, much tighter, much more kind of flowing from one season to the next, so that it becomes truly timeless and seasonless. Somebody can pick up something from this collection and they can wear it back with something they bought a year, 2 years, 5 years ago, and everything's always going to work together. It's always going to interchange. We no longer discount. We make mostly to order. And all of the pieces that you see here, we call that our circular stock. So somebody can come in, they can purchase it, and then we will replace it, or we'll decide to replace it with something different. It keeps a really dynamic and exciting environment within our space. And I think it's an interesting thought process of a different way to work, I think.
I mean, do you consider that to be the luxury space? Because it's not possible for the big corporations to work in that way, because of, you know, just the scale of the business. So that's the distinction between how you operate and how somebody with 200 stores around the world operates.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I think there is a luxury in having something that's a little more exclusive, right? I think part of luxury has always been a certain exclusivity. And I think that by returning to that kind of model or considering that as a different way to work, you're also providing that level of exclusivity to your client that is actually quite priceless. Mm. We found people really enjoy the fact that there's not that many of them made, and you know, they have something that is, it feels really special to them.
And that's the
that it, for that's me, that's the luxury. That is the luxury. Yeah. Yes.
And then it's followed on by your choice of fabrics and by
the choice of fabric, by, you know, how we help our clients care for their garments. We share knowledge about how you should clean it or how you should wash it, or, you know, all of that information, how you look after it over time. And I think what happens with that, let's call it very special relationship between the garment and the wearer, is it becomes part of their life. It becomes part of their life's journey. It becomes a sort of partner in their wardrobe, if you like. Mm. And, you know, we want our pieces to be the pieces that, you know, you go back to time and time again in the wardrobe, that you say, oh, what do I feel like wearing today? I've got this really important thing. I want to feel my best. We want our pieces to be the pieces you pull out to feel like that about mm. yourself.
But all the time.
Yeah,
it's not a yeah, it's not a special... Because, I mean, in the old days, it was like, oh, I'd keep this for best.
Yes, and actually, I think the notion of that's changed. Our lifestyles have sped up, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, even myself, I'm running from one thing to the next. I need a garment that's going to see me through all the different things that are perhaps going to happen to me in my day, from, you know, sitting here doing an interview with you to perhaps, you know, sitting on the floor pinning a hem for somebody later, right? I need to be able to do all of that in what I'm wearing. And then, you know, if I don't know, go home and I'm doing cooking, I'm not worried about if I get food on this dress because I can put it in the washing machine. It's an easy to care for piece, you know? So it works with me and my lifestyle. It doesn't feel precious. It feels part of who I am as a woman.
And that, well, that, there's another interesting thought, is that there's a luxury in being able to do that. I mean, I suppose a lot of clients who are buying clothes at the really top end, so clothes that are quite expensive, probably don't, you know, do the same things that you do. They probably don't wash their own clothes or do the cooking or...
some do, some don't. Yeah. We have actually clients at really all different levels.
Yeah.
And we have clients that save up to own a pair of our magic trousers, for example. That is a huge investment for them to own a pair of trousers like that. But they know that they're going to keep it for a really long time. So, you know, I really see that. We have, you know, and obviously we have clients that are incredibly wealthy also.
Sure. But don't do the washing.
But I'm frequently told, even by those,
yeah,
you know, how much they enjoy wearing the pieces over and over again over time. You know, chatting to somebody who, you know, obviously has some of our trousers from 14 years ago, she said, I'm still wearing them along with all these blouses that I bought from you. And, you know, I'd never met this lady before, but she was sharing that with me. And that, for me, that's lovely. It means that I'm doing my job.
Yeah.
This is my job. My job is to do that for women. So when I hear stories like that from women about, you know, I'm still wearing that dress 20 years later, and it's still an important part of my wardrobe, or, you know, I've passed it down now because I don't wear it anymore, I don't fit it, but now my daughter's wearing it, or my daughter's friend's wearing it, or, you know, it brings me a huge amount of joy and gratification, because it means I know I've done a really good job.
Yeah. How do you think luxury's changed over the past 10 years? I mean, I know we spoke for the podcast, I think it was season one, and that's like 3 years ago. How do you think luxury's changed even since then? Because I remember asking you how you thought luxury had changed the previous 5 to 10 years, and I was wondering if you thought that the perceptions of luxury had changed in the past 3 years since we spoke.
Well, you know, I think that you picked up on that a little bit earlier with your comment about celebrities and red carpets and things like that. I feel that the notion of a kind of luxury brand, a brand, rather than, you know, luxury per se, has shifted because we value as a culture or as a, you know, of the consumer, let's say, values a name quite often above what's behind it or the craft or something. And I think that that has been a gradual shift over a much longer period of time. But I think it's beginning to change and shift and break down a little bit. Not with everybody, but there's certain pockets of people now that are understanding the way the sort of luxury business has been built. That actually this whole business model of let's build your name as big as you can so you can sell as much stuff underneath that as possible, because that's essentially what it is. Mm. It's not really luxury at all. And the real luxury comes from something that's really beautifully made, well-crafted, pays the workers really well. And that consciousness is beginning to creep in. And I'd say over the last 12 months in particular, that's really started to hit a kind of conversation that's beginning to happen across all different levels of the market, not just at the luxury end, it's at many different levels of the market. Yeah. But I started to see that just beginning, finally.
Finally. But do you think, I mean, again, this is probably the cynic in me. Do you think, I mean, it's great to have the conversations, and it's really important to have conversations about, you know, I also think people are becoming much more aware of the environment. They're becoming much more aware of the damage they're doing to the environment. You know, I work with somebody and I was going to get coffee and getting a paper cup, and she was appalled.
Yeah, that you don't carry a keep cup.
Yeah. So I've now got a, you know, I use a keep cup. And even when I went into get coffee this morning and Chris bought a plastic bottle with water, I was thinking he normally carries a water bottle with him, you know, things like that. And so I'm, you know, becoming more conscious about my own actions. And I was wondering, you know, we say that people are talking about this stuff, but are they 100%. Taking action?
100% at my end of the market, 100%. So we now don't really have people coming in to buy something just for a wedding, let's say. Let's use that as a good example, because 10 years ago, 15 years ago, a lot of people were coming, I need a special dress for a wedding, and they're really just buying it for that one occasion. Whereas I think now what we see is, I need something for a wedding, but I want something I'm going to be able to wear again. Yeah. And it's always part of the narrative. So the conversation is more than a conversation. It's how people are starting to think about their wardrobe and their clothes. And I, you know, and we really help women to do that. Yeah. And, you know, but we've always done that. So it's a, let's call it, it's a welcome conversation when people come in. So we'll help them find that. And even those super wealthy people, by the way.
Yeah.
Even those super wealthy people, and I'm sorry, I can't name names.
No.
But it's been a pleasure to see that, you know, I'm now seeing some of those people re-wearing those pieces that they bought from me 5-10 years ago to many different occasions. They're not afraid to be seen again in the same dress. It's no longer a stigma associated with that. In fact, it's seen as a positive environmental choice.
Honor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I think those things really have shifted. It's hard for me to comment on whether that's shifted, say, in the high street or in the street level of things. But certainly at my end of the market, in the luxury space, I really do believe, and perhaps I attract the kind of customer. I mean, you know, obviously I've, you know, always been a little bit like that in terms of my brand. So perhaps I'm attracting that kind of customer. And so perhaps I see it more as a little bit of that conversation too. But certainly that really is a very important part of the customer behavior that I see here.
Do those customers think of what they're buying as being a luxury item, or is that not something they even consider? Do they, you know, are they just buying a piece of clothing that they will treasure and wear for a long time, or?
I think a little bit of both. I think that, you know, we've had conversations with, you know, a number of our clients. You know, one lady was sharing with me that in the past she used to have different clothes for different aspects of her life, and now she just has one wardrobe. She considers everything she buys as, I have got to be able to wear it in lots of different ways, in many different ways for my life. And some of those things will be more dressed up things, and some of these things will be more dressed down things. But I think she sees her clothing as something that's going to support her life, but she also wants it to feel luxurious and to be luxurious. And the luxury of having clothes to do that is, you know, because we all, you know, the biggest luxury in anyone's life is time. So to be able to have clothing that is almost, you don't have to think about, in a way, gives you that internal luxury as well as feeling luxurious on the skin, and they know that it's beautifully made. I think all of those things are values that are important.
Mm. I was going to say, I wonder if that's true, that the biggest luxury is everybody, for everyone, is time. Because that's, whenever I ask somebody, what's your luxury? A lot of people say time. And then I often think, well, is it time? Because some people have lots of time.
Well, time is relative, obviously. Yeah. But I think that in a...
I'm just being obstinate.
In the world that we live in, we're expected, and digital has actually sped up time.
Yeah.
You know, if you go back, you realize how things were to how things are now. And as digital has, you know, in some ways it has freed us, but it has also trapped us, because we're expected to do so much more, to be so much more productive. We're always on with our devices, that we are contactable by email. There's a million different communication platforms now that we're expected to keep up with. You know, as the owner of a business in the past, you'd have a PA that would handle all of this for you. You'd have a briefing in the morning. She would do all of your administration. You'd be free to go do your job as a creator. Now I do all of my own administration. Does that really save me time? Am I really doing the things I love to do all of the time? You know, is digital actually a good or a bad thing? And maybe it's a way of us using it in a better way that frees us more and gives us more available time for the things that we enjoy and love to do.
Yeah.
But I don't know how many people use it that well, you know? So I think that the reason the biggest luxury is time is because actually we all feel a massive pressure on our time from the amount of things that we have to do and commit to in any day. And I think it's true of pretty much everyone.
Yeah. I was just wondering if these are first world conversations. You know, often I think about talking about luxury, and in the context that I do, just feels quite, just think, kind of reflecting on the conversation, it feels quite alien, because it's so focused on a particular demographic, so to speak, because the world is a big place, and, you know, sitting on Jermyn Street in London is not the same as sitting, you know, in a cotton field, like you were talking about earlier, in Brazil, for example.
Well, you don't feel like even the people that work those cotton fields in Brazil might feel that the biggest luxury is time for themselves, to just have their own moment of time in whichever way that they might wish to spend it. I think it doesn't matter at any level. I feel like we all long for that stillness and moment to just be sometimes, and we don't allow ourselves to be as often.
No, and that's interesting, because, and that's where this, the conversation about luxury becomes quite interesting, because it's not about the things that we own.
No, it's about the relationship that we have actually with those things, which is kind of what I was talking about, going right back to the beginning, is the relationship that you have, the feelings that it gives you, the, I suppose, pleasures in a way that it gives you, to either to look at something, to feel something, to enjoy something, to be with it in a certain way, is where real luxury, I think, inhabits, let's say. It's not about a name or a brand or a label. It's something much deeper than that.
And that's why those marketing guys have done such amazing jobs with those enormous, you know, these enormous brands, because they're not actually selling the product.
No, you're selling a name.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it's,
and that's fine.
I think, like anything, you know, these are cultural moments. Yeah. And I think people are becoming aware. I think that there's been, you know, that there was a moment in history where those brands or those names did stand for that quality and that beauty, and that there was a real desirability to those pieces. But I think as fashion has sped up and consumption has sped up, there's been other things that have got in the way of that beauty. And I think over what's beginning to happen now is you're starting to see people really see that, really recognize that it's just a bubble.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that that luxury has now become so intertwined with fashion, whereas it's not really about fashion, as in clothing.
Mm-hmm.
But the fashion brands, clothing brands, have adopted this term and applied it to all their wares, when in actual fact, that's not what it is for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, I think it's really coming down to that sort of education piece of just trying to shift the narrative and shift the conversation a little bit, to, you know, to bringing that awareness to what real luxury is, to appreciating perhaps the craft behind things, whether it's fashion or making of anything, in fact, and understanding the impact of consumerism and disposability on the environment, in fact, because, you know, a lot of people, I think most people now, are quite environmentally conscious. But I'd say there's, you know, a little bit of a kind of confusion, perhaps, of, well, how do I do things better? You know, I still feel that the awareness is, you know, there's different levels of it. But I think that there's still kind of a growing awareness, let's say, of the importance of some of these things. And that shift or that kind of idea on the kind of consumption and the waste and all of that is really beginning to become a bit more mainstream and a bit more into people's vision, let's say. So I think as that starts to happen, it's only going to be natural that some of those things that have been really important will start to break down
and
be questioned.
Yeah. I remember Anja Heinmarsch said, you don't really appreciate the damage we're doing to the environment until you go to a landfill site and you actually see and smell, you know, you see the vastness of the space and smell the damage.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've never been to a landfill site, but I can just imagine how awful it might be. But the education thing, you know, you're talking about, I'm thinking, well, how do we get people to actually see the damage that we're doing? Because most people are so oblivious to it. Could, you know, when I walk, if I buy something, I don't think, oh my, if it's an expensive piece of whatever it might be, I don't think to myself, oh, I'm buying luxury. But that's me, you know. But I wonder if other people, you know, kind of think that when they're walking into a store and buying a bag that's £6,000, if they think it's a luxury. I wonder if there's a mindset that thinks, oh, I'm buying luxury. I wonder, do you think that people think that?
Yes, I think that, you know, I think that there's different types of connection with luxury, and different consumers are somewhere at different points of the journey around luxury. And there's definitely still people that say, this brand is luxury.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a growing awareness in, let's call it the real luxury consumer, that that's not luxury and we're seeking something that's much more exclusive. But it's very much at the beginning part of that. It hasn't reached a tipping point yet. You have to go through the waves, sort of almost kind of going down before it reaches that tipping point. But we are at least at a point where it's cool to be seen in vintage clothes. You know, it's cool to be shopping on, you know, websites that sell old clothes. It's cool to be, you know, expressing your own style and not following, you know, if the miniskirts are in, then everyone must wear miniskirts. You know, that's been the case for years. Mm. So it's a process. It's a gradual process of time that has to evolve. I mean, consumerism wasn't born overnight. It was years and years and years of marketing to get to that. So you have to appreciate that it takes years and years and years of marketing in the opposite direction to undo all of that.
Absolutely.
It's a process of time.
And I get that. But then I suppose within a fashion context, a lot of companies are saying, oh, we are being sustainable. The wool's sustainable. The cotton's sustainable. We're doing this, we're doing that. But in actual fact, they're still making the same amount of product. Mm. So how sustainable can it really be? Even if they're saying, bring your old T-shirt back, we'll recycle it. Or, you know, certain things can be recycled, certain things can't be recycled. But I just wonder, you know, fashion in itself is not a sustainable industry.
Well, I think, you know, my point of view is that there's a carbon impact to every single thing that's made.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is,
yeah.
Whether it's fashion, technology,
yeah,
which
food.
Is also equally disposable, everything.
Yeah.
So it's really about sustainability is about living within the boundaries of the planet. And fashion has way exceeded it in terms of the volume of product made. And it's part of the reason that I made the decision that I did, that instead of tackling fabric first and just swapping out my fabric for a more sustainable fabric. And it's true that a lot of the carbon impact of your overall product is within that fabric. But if you're sort of producing this much still of using a much more environmentally sound fabric, but this much of it's going to waste, you've still got this much that nobody's talking about.
Mm.
So for me, I wanted to kind of address that first, bring it down to every single piece that we're making now is intentional. It's going into somebody's wardrobe that is going to be loved and cared for and is going to last a really long time. We're not producing for the sake of producing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think if a lot more brands kind of joined in on that conversation and started to action that a little bit more, you'd automatically reduce the carbon impact of the fashion industry right down.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I wonder is the impact on the high street and on communities. Because so many stores are closing. You know, in London, New York, Cape Town, wherever you might be, so many stores are closing because so many businesses are struggling to survive. And that is partially because people aren't buying as much.
That's why I said it's already happening.
Yeah, but then what happens?
Then I think there's a natural process, like everything, you know. There's always spring, summer, autumn, winter, right? And part of that process is things have to die off for new things to be born.
Mm.
And the industry, by its very nature, has become unsustainable. It's been unsustainable for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, if you take that example of we're building our name up in order to be able to sell lots and lots and lots of things like that, and that's the business model that works, but actually only works when you get to that point where you've got the fragrance and the, you know, the handbags and the, you know, beauty line and the this, that and the other. And during that 10, 15 year process of building this name to be able to sell all this stuff, your businesses are technically unsustainable because technically you're constantly making a loss year after year after year after year. That is not a sustainable business. Mm. You know, a business that's sustainable makes a profit to be able to pay everyone fairly and well and to be able to pay the owners of the business, to be able to reinvest and grow the business organically. And when you grow the business organically, you say, okay, well, you know, now we can grow in small ways incrementally over time. It's a completely different business model. It's perhaps a more old-fashioned business model, but I think the fashion industry has adopted a different type of thing where you invest very heavily in the name, but actually most of the time you make a huge loss, and a lucky few will make it big and get the name big enough to do that. But is that a sustainable
business? Luckily financially,
yeah. But the impact of that type of business, the global impact of all of that stuff that's made, that actually wasn't really needed, because if it was, it would be profitable, feels inherently wrong to me.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about the make of your stuff, because you pride yourself on the textiles, on the print, because you design all the prints yourself, and on the manufacture. Just tell us a bit about your kind of design thought process in creating one of your garments.
Well, it kind of always starts with the woman. So I really think about the way a garment inhabits a woman's body. So for me, a great garment starts with cut and fit. And we've always been known for our cut and fit. When you put on one of my pieces, it's kind of hard to describe until you put it on the body. You can really tell the difference between my pair of trousers, for example, and another pair of trousers, because they cut to fit. Yeah. We don't, you know, most people, that when they try the trousers on, they can't believe that it doesn't need some sort of adjustment here and there. It's usually just the length, but they just fit on the waist, on the hips. They sit beautifully, they hang beautifully. And the only thing to adjust is, well, depending on what shoes you're going to wear, the length and the hem of the trouser. And there's an art in that, to be able to cut something beautifully that works across lots of different body shapes and lots of different women's bodies. And I really value that art, whether it's trousers or a dress or, you know, and I cut in many different ways. And I suppose because I've been doing that since I was, 14, I started developing my own pattern blocks and my own cutting techniques. And I have a very unique way of thinking about the body. And a lot of that comes, I suppose, from the experience and just time. 30, 40 years of making things, trying them on, saying, yeah, this is good, but I can improve that. I can improve that. And I see it as a constant improvement and a constant learning, that I'm always developing and building better and better and better product. I love to think of it like that. So with the cut and the fit, that comes first. The fabric obviously is an intrinsic part of that, because fabric has almost a property of its own, the way that it moves, the way that it drapes. So cut and fabric kind of go together. You consider both of them at the same time. And I'm kind of rare that I cut my own patterns, which most designers don't do. But I really see that as such an important part of my design process that I continue to do that. And then with the prints, you know, what I love to do with my cut is to sculpt the body. And so I take away seams where I don't want extra bulk or, you know, shape. And I use seams to create sculpture. And equally, I take print and I see that almost as 3D art on the body. So I'm taking the line of the garment, the line of the way it's cut, and also considering the body inside and shaping it and painting it, so that you create almost like, you create a sculpture on the body. So if you take this dress, you can see how the shadow of it almost gives you a waist, gives you a shape, gives you a kind of line that you know it's going to make you taller and slimmer and enhance your body. Yeah. So I love to play with textile and print and cut all around the idea of essentially making you, let's say, taller, slimmer, hiding parts of the body you don't want to show and enhancing parts of the body that you feel good about. And I guess that's why I talk about my clothes as being really kind of empowering, I suppose. So that's my process for every part of the design. And then, you know, in terms of manufacturing, when you come to that, again, it's technical experience over many years, but you know what seams to use on different fabrics for the longevity. And we spend quite a lot of time working out little tiny details, even things like, so on my Oxford trousers, the pockets are put underneath the pleats at the front so that there's no extra bulk when you wear them. You can put something in your pocket and it doesn't add extra bulk. It's super flattering to wear. You can just feel effortlessly comfortable in them. And those, they're small design details, but they're also the way the garment's put together to create a better product.
Cool. Last time we spoke, my last question to you was what your luxury was. Same question 3 years later. I wonder if that's changed. What is your luxury?
Well, it does go back to the luxury of time. And I think that certainly one of the benefits of slowing down, you know, creating slow fashion rather than something on a traditional fashion model, is it has given me more time. And with that time, you know, having that luxury to just be is, I think, something we all need to build more into our lives. And I cherish every moment that I have to be able to just be in that zone of being able to be and to be free in my thoughts and free in my thinking and free in that kind of creativity. And for me, that's the most beautiful luxury.
Maria Grashvogel, thank you so much for joining us on the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Always fun chatting.
It is yeah. Always fun chatting.
Always fun chatting. You don't know what is going to come out, do you?
No, exactly.
Might have gone in a different direction than you
exactly.
Said.
Exactly. I don't know. You know, that's great. Thank you. Thank you to Maria for joining us. And thank you for listening and or watching. And thank you to our sponsors, Intellibooks. And don't forget, you can catch up on all previous episodes of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast on your favorite listening and or watching platform. Join us next time on the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast.